I'm Chris Sturr. Next on Unwelcome Guests, we'd like to bring to your attention two recent articles which relate one of the issues we've been discussing, the issue of locating prisons in rural areas, to our own region and in particular to the recent construction of a maximum security prison in Seneca County. As we will see, each of the two articles, one is from the New York Times and the other is from The Nation magazine, could benefit from an upstate, rural perspective on the issue. The following from the New York Times Metro section of June 25th, 2000, a piece entitled "One Community's Lawbreakers Are Another's Growth Industry" by Matthew Purdy in the Our Towns column. Dateline Romulus, New York. From his porch, Ray Zajac can hear the inmates' voices rising through the double set of glistening razor wire fences across Main Street. The late afternoon chanting of men exercising in the drug treatment center is money to his ears. "The city is subsidizing us by producing these criminals," said Mr. Zajac, meaning New York City. It's not a nice thing to say, but it's true. That subsidy is about to soar. Once the state's Five Points prison opens here in August, Romulus will be home to 3,200 free-ranging souls and 2,200 inmates. The free-rangers aren't complaining. "It's a salvation to us," said Mr. Zajac, who has run this Finger Lakes town as the elected supervisor for 29 years. Romulus is a village saved by prisons. The state psychiatric hospital on Main Street closed in 1995, but reopened as the Department of Correctional Services' Willard Drug Treatment Campus. The 11,000-acre Seneca Army Depot began closing that same year, but the state came through with the $180 million prison now being completed on a secluded corner of the base. "It's the largest construction project ever in the Finger Lakes," said Michael F. Nozzolio, the local state senator and chairman of the Senate's Corrections Committee, who brought home this juicy morsel of bacon. Beyond the projected 638 full-time jobs and 191 spin-off jobs, the prison will also rescue Romulus from its own sewage. Wastewater from about 200 homes near the prison site and Romulus's only school ran through the Army's system for decades. With the Army leaving, the hamlet would need a new system, which it could not afford. But the prison's water and sewer systems will serve the town as well and pay the local sewer district, which will run it, an estimated $2 million a year, said the district's administrator, the same Ray Zajac. "It's a big business, crime is," he said. Political, too, Sentiment is growing in New York State to rethink drug laws that have helped push the prison population over 71,000. And last week, the state's chief judge announced an effort to send more addicts to treatment rather than jail. But the legislature ended its session Friday with no action on proposals to ease the state's harshest drug statutes, the Rockefeller-era laws that mandate minimum sentences of 15 years to life for possession or sale of small amounts of drugs, stiffer sentences than the minimums for rape or manslaughter. Fear of appearing weak on crime overcame political will. The inaction in Albany and the construction activity here, 160 miles west, demonstrate that there is just one safe political course when it comes to sentencing wrongdoers. Put the pedal to the metal. But don't blame Romulus. Aside from some better-off folks with houses on serene Seneca Lake, Romulus is a collection of three tattered hamlets that largely lived off the state mental hospital and the Cold War threat of global conflict that kept the World War II Army Depot alive until the Berlin Wall fell. The world has changed, and now Romulus will have a drug treatment center, a maximum security prison, and a nonprofit center for troubled youths that Governor George E. Pataki helped inaugurate on Wednesday. "We're going from government to government," said Dennis Aloya, the Seneca County manager. "When you're a hungry area, like this place is, you're willing to accept things that other places aren't." Prisons are bonanzas in depressed areas, and Glenn R. Cook, Seneca County's development director, calls Senator Nozzolio our rainmaker. The senator has six prisons in his district, and the public policy group City Project says more than a third of the state's prisons are in the districts of three senators, Mr. Nozzolio included. In Romulus, Sandy Lind, the postmaster, is expecting business to skyrocket. Deanna LaPrade said the medical office, where she works as a nurse, had hired an additional doctor, anticipating an influx of prison employees. And she said the guard jobs, with good pay and benefits, will give grown children a reason to stay in town. "It's a nice touch," she said. But if the world changes again, and there is a move to reduce the nation's world-beating incarceration rates, it will cause economic upheaval for places like Romulus. Not that anyone is expecting, as Mr. Zajac said, all the criminals to find the Lord, or for all the politicians to go soft. "I think it's less likely that will happen," Mr. Zajac said, "than the Berlin Wall coming down." That was an article entitled, "One Community's Lawbreakers Are Another's Growth Industry," from the New York Times Metro section of June 25, 2000. First of all, although the Times reporter is somewhat sympathetic in the end about the reasons a town like Romulus might buy into the prison building boom to boost its economy, the article as a whole displays the Times' usual condescending attitude towards upstate, especially small rural upstate towns. The article does usefully put our economy into a larger context. Still, a couple of corrections are in order. First of all, for local residents, it was an open secret for years that the Seneca Army Depot, where the new state maximum security prison is being located, housed nuclear weapons. Since the closing of the depot, the world now knows that it may have housed the largest collection of nuclear weapons in North America. The Times mentions none of this, though it is relevant to the question of what the government may owe to towns like Romulus. Also, what the Times and New York State call the Willard Drug Treatment Campus is in fact a boot camp-style prison for young drug offenders. It is not surprising that a quote-unquote drug treatment facility run by the Department of Corrections takes a dehumanizing, often brutal boot camp approach, but it is highly misleading of the state and the Times to suggest that this counts as drug treatment. Whatever they call it, it's certainly not the kind of drug treatment opponents of the drug war have been calling for as an alternative to incarceration. Finally, and most importantly, the New York Times reporter claims that we free-ranging souls near the new state prison in Seneca County aren't complaining about these facilities in our midst. But in fact, not everyone shares the views Ray Zajac expresses in the article. While we're sympathetic with Mr. Zajac's quest for economic support for the area, many of us question the political and economic system that makes the prison building boom and the drug war the only place he can look for such support. For one thing, we should be glad that State Senator Nozzolio brings state-funded projects to the area, but is this really the best he could do? Where are we as a community when the best we can hope for is new prison construction for economic development? Couldn't Senator Nozzolio bring back economic development projects that don't depend on the drug war or on housing other communities' prisoners? Why couldn't Nozzolio just get state funding to help Romulus build its own sewage system? Given the years and years of risk people in and around Romulus faced when the depot was a nuclear weapons facility, you'd think that state or federal government could foot the bill for a sewage system for the village. Surely that would have cost less than a new prison. We also shouldn't overemphasize the economic boon these prisons are for our communities. The construction jobs for the prison have been good jobs, but have not necessarily gone to local contractors or workers, and in any case, they have been only a temporary economic benefit. What's more, many of the jobs in the new maximum security prison are not likely to go to locals. Like all state divisions, the Department of Correctional Facilities has a system of training and seniority, and positions at the new facility in Romulus are likely to be plum jobs reserved for more senior employees in the department. If locals are hired by the department, they're more likely to be sent down to Sing Sing than offered jobs here. Furthermore, when people throughout the state and the country do begin to rethink the drug war and begin to question our country's incredible rate of incarceration, then the boot camp-style facility for drug offenders and the maximum security prison may well go the way of the Seneca Army Depot. If that happens, even more people may begin to realize that they have been ill-served by the likes of Michael Nozzolio. In the meantime, politicians like Nozzolio and the boards of directors of corporations in the prison industry profit from high rates of incarceration, and they have managed to make good people from small towns like Romulus complicit in the imprisonment of huge percentages of young men of color from urban parts of our state, often for nonviolent crimes. As the article points out, under the Rockefeller drug laws, penalties for possession of sale of small amounts of drugs are stiffer than the minimums for rape or manslaughter. Do we really want our town's economies to depend on laws like that?
Next, an article from the July 17, 2000 issue of The Nation magazine, entitled Prisoner Nation by Beverly Gage. According to Census 2000, America's third great migration is underway. During the first two, millions of African Americans abandoned the country for the city. Today, the migration appears to be just the reverse. According to anticipated census figures, hundreds of thousands of blacks and Latinos have flocked from city to country over the past decade. As the census count draws to a close, government dollars and voting clout will begin to follow. But these transplants won't benefit from the roads, schools, and bridges built with federal funds. They are prisoners, counted by the census as residents of the towns where they are serving time. With approximately 2 million people incarcerated nationwide, the census technicality will be a multi-billion dollar boon to the rural towns that house most of the nation's prisoners. It's just one of a series of unintended consequences of large-scale incarceration, says Mark Maurer, assistant director of the Sentencing Project, a Washington-based group that advocates criminal justice reform. Like so many other byproducts of the prison boom, the skewed census count will have the direst consequences for the inner city, which loses federal funds and voting power with every inmate shipped out. In New York, for example, two-thirds of the state's 71,000 prisoners serve their time upstate, usually in rural Republican strongholds. More than 80% of those prisoners are black or Latino, and about 70% come from a few select areas of New York City. As a recent report from City Project, a New York-based urban advocacy group, sums up, quote, "The state's prison policies effectively transfer public funds and electoral influence from low-income inner-city neighborhoods of color
to white rural upstate areas, end quote. The past few decades have seen the rise of prisoners as quote-unquote captive consumers, in the words of criminologist Nils Christie. Prized for the services they require, the money they attract, and the jobs they create. With the federal government prepared to distribute at least $185 billion a year over the next decade, solely according to census figures, every warm body has become a valuable commodity. Prisoners are better than most at pulling in federal dollars. Generally impoverished, they skew communities' income stats downward, making prison towns prime candidates for poverty-directed funds. Aside from the occasional trip to court or a few daily toilet flushes, they exert little strain on the local infrastructure. Eager to cash in on federal largesse, prison towns, even entire states, have rushed to embrace their incarcerated brethren. This spring, Representative Mark Green of Wisconsin sponsored a bill allowing states to claim census credit for inmates shipped out of state. In Arizona, a recent law permitting towns to annex nearby prisons resulted in a fierce bidding war, with the victorious municipality reaping $1.3 million in additional government munificence. The state of Minnesota, hoping to assure a full prisoner count, paid inmates $1 for filling out their forms. In addition to financial perks, the census count will offer a power boost for prison towns. With voting representation determined by population, every extra inmate means added political influence. Even better, inmates can't vote, so their presence simply enhances the clout of local residents. In New York State, that means enhancing Republican clout. According to the City Project report, 64 of the state's 71 prisons are located in Republican districts. The problem of representation may be particularly acute in states like Georgia, which will use the 2000 census to determine new voting districts. In such states, the census's misleadingly multicultural portrait could result in a boundary distortion, since race will be one of several factors used to determine voting districts. The only question, says the Sentencing Project's Maurer, is, quote, whether it's a modest impact or a significant one, end quote. It's not that census counters have conspired to rob cities of their rightful inhabitants. The census has long classified prisons as special places, like colleges and homeless shelters. Like prisons, some of these other special places, colleges in particular, give rural communities a population boost. But college students, unlike prisoners, are relatively typical residents. They use local roads, shop in local shops, rent local real estate, and partake of local government services. Unlike prisoners, college students can vote, making them symbolically, if not actually, members of the local community. Most important, college students rarely cause a significant shift in an area's racial or economic profile. The problem is not census policy, but the skyrocketing prison population. The issue was the same 30 years ago, Maurer says, but with six times as many people in prison today, the combined impact is much more significant than we've ever seen before. And there are no indications that it's about to slow down. The census counts Americans where they live, and the sorry fact is that 2 million Americans live in prison. There's no right way to count that. That was an article entitled Prisoner Nation by Beverly Gage from the July 17, 2000 issue of The Nation magazine. Here again, this report could have benefited from the perspective of people in upstate New York whose economy and political position is supposed to be boosted by prison construction. When people from the organization called City Project speak of transferring, quote, public funds and electoral influence from low-income inner-city neighborhoods of color to white rural upstate areas, end quote, they fail to point out that at least some of those predominantly white rural upstate areas are themselves low-income. They're not locating prisons in wealthy suburbs. There are certainly important racial issues here, But we shouldn't forget that the working people of Seneca County have more in common with inner-city people of color than they do with the wealthy politicians and corporate managers and board members who truly profit from the prison-industrial complex. This seems to be yet another case of the powers that be pitting white working people against black and Latino working people to the benefit of those very powers that be, and to the detriment of the rest of us. Instead of pitting urban black people and Latinos against rural white people, the City Project should be enlisting rural white people in the struggle against racism and corporate control of public resources. The City Project also frets about the fact that 64 of the state's 71 prisons are located in Republican districts, and about the enhanced Republican clout created by the migration of prisoners from cities to rural areas. Here again, we must remember that rural areas themselves are often as poor as urban areas, sometimes poorer. Nozzolio and his Republican colleagues are indeed bringing back funding and political clout for themselves and their Republican districts, but they're also bringing them back for the people of their districts. Do the folks at the City Project and the Nation magazine think rural districts don't need economic support and political clout? Let's not lose sight of what really is objectionable about the trends they are pointing out. It's not the fact that people in rural areas are getting more funding and political clout, but the fact that it takes the form of prisons. In any case, if, as I've pointed out, the people of Seneca County are not benefiting from the prison construction as much as the politicians want them to think, then the real transfer of funds is not from urban to rural, but, as usual, from working people and poor people to rich people, politicians and corporations. By objecting to increased Republican control, the City Project and the Nation magazine are just helping the rich pit rural working people and poor people against urban working people and poor people in a pathetic struggle for resources that politicians and corporations want you to think are scarce. Instead, the City Project and the Nation magazine should be looking for the issues on which rural and urban folks share political interests. Finally, putting the focus on increased Republican control obscures the fact that the Democratic Party has supported the drug war and the high rate of incarceration nearly as enthusiastically as the Republicans have. When you think about it, the only ones that really benefit in the long run from the drug war and the prison-building frenzy are politicians and corporations. The rest of us, whether we're urban, rural, black, Latino, or white, need to join together to stop the transfer of funds from working people to corporations and politicians, and the incarceration and criminalization of a whole generation of young men of color.
This is a life, a job and desire.
The song we just heard is On the Outside by St. Lo, a local band, two of whose members reside in Seneca County. That song is from their album, St. Lo.
This is Radio Democracy, a series of 12 commentaries by the noted author and political analyst, Michael Parenti. This segment is titled, The Lazy Law and Social Control. The police and the law are dedicated less to fighting crime and more to defending the social-economic status quo.
Let's talk about the law today. Through most of the history of labor struggle, law officers have been on the side of the bosses. Police have either looked the other way or actively cooperated when company goons and vigilantes attacked union organizers and picketers. In recent years, in various parts of the country, police have attacked striking farm laborers, truckers, miners, meat packers, janitors, and factory and construction workers, arresting and injuring hundreds. Many workers have been imprisoned for resisting court injunctions against strikes and pickets, and even for shouting at scab workers or daring to talk back to police while on picket lines. In Elmwood, Indiana, 7 strikers were shot by company goons. A striking coal miner in Harlan County, Kentucky, was shot dead by a gun thug, as was another miner in McDowell County, West Virginia, and a farm worker in Texas. In none of these cases did police apprehend anyone, despite eyewitness evidence of the identity of the killers. Working people generally have very little reason to be happy about the law, and they have a lot of reason to complain about how the law is enforced. The law and its enforcement agents do many worthwhile things. I'll grant that. I'm very happy to say that many laws enhance public safety and individual security. The police sometimes protect life and limb, direct traffic, administer first aid, assist in times of community emergency, and perform other services with commendable dedication and courage. But aside from this desirable social service function, the police also serve a class control function. That is, they must protect those who rule from those who are ruled. And they protect the interests of capital and property, big property, from those who would challenge the inequities of the system, or those who advocate any kind of redistribution or reformist politics. The profiteering corporate managers, plundering slumlords, swindling merchants, racist school boards, special interest legislators, and others who contribute so much to the scarcity, misery, and anger that lead to individual crimes or mass riots, they leave the dirty work of subduing these outbursts to the police. When the police charge picket lines, beating, gassing, and occasionally shooting workers, they usually are operating with a court injunction that allows them to exert force in order to protect the interests of the corporate owners. The police confront dangers and social miseries of a kind most of us can only imagine. They deal with the damaged and oppressed products of a competitive, free market society, the ill-fed, the ill-housed, the desperate, and the defeated. The slums are not the problem, they are the solution. They are the way of dealing with the surplus people of a market economy. And it's the job of the police to sweep protests and poverty under the rug, even if it takes a gun. When directed towards social reforms that benefit the many, the law often appears ineffective. But when it's mobilized against political dissenters, the resources of the law appear boundless, and enforcement is pursued with a kind of vigor that itself becomes lawless. So, after a while, people learn that they're not as free as they might think. If they engage in progressive causes that challenge privileged interests, they risk being targeted for repression. One mechanism of repression is the grand jury, supposedly intended to weigh the state's evidence and protect the innocent from unjustifiable prosecution. The grand jury usually ends up doing whatever the prosecution wants. Grand juries have been used to conduct fishing expeditions against persons with unconventional political views, required to appear without benefit of counsel, without being told the nature of the investigation. Dissidents have been forced to answer questions about their political ideas, their personal associations, or face imprisonment for refusing. The upshot is to turn them into involuntary informers regarding any conversation or activity to which they have been privy. Another political control agency is the Internal Revenue Service, or the IRS, known affectionately to many of us, especially in mid-April. The IRS has gone after dissidents for purposes having little to do with tax collection. A General Accounting Office study found that some 28 civil rights leaders were audited repeatedly. The Communist Party had its assets seized and was illegally denied tax exemption for years, while the two major pro-capitalist parties, the Republicans and Democrats, or Demicans and Republicrats, as some people say, they enjoyed uninterrupted tax exemption. The IRS has investigated the Black Panther Party, Students for a Democratic Society, Socialist Worker Party, gay rights advocates, environmental groups, anti-war groups, liberal politicians, and many other politically oriented individuals, organizations, and publications. Not to get more taxes out of them or to keep them honest on taxes, but to harass them and use the tax laws as a way of hamstringing them. Loyalty and security checks have been used by government agencies to deny public employment to people of anti-capitalist persuasion. Private sector employees have no First Amendment protection from bosses who might fire them because of their political views. The right to political opinions, which, by the way, is a right in a country like the Netherlands, the right to have whatever political opinion you want without suffering deprivation or punishment does not exist in this country. Discrimination on the basis of race, class, or religious orientation is against the law, but not discrimination on the basis of your political views. The courts have ruled that the Constitution prohibits the government, but not private businesses or institutions, from suppressing speech. In other words, if your boss doesn't like your opinions about GATT or the environment or about minimum wage laws or about U.S. foreign policy, he can fire you if he wants to. People with affiliations to anti-capitalist groups have been hounded out of jobs in labor unions, academia, entertainment, industry, and various other fields by both private employers and government investigators. During the Vietnam War, protesters were attacked by police on dozens of campuses throughout the country and in major demonstrations in many cities. At Kent State, protesters were killed. In Orangeburg, in Jackson State, students were also killed. Many were wounded by police and guardsmen. From 1968 to 1971, police attacked the headquarters of the Black Panther Party, a Marxist revolutionary organization, in more than 10 cities. By the way, the Black Panther Party also was involved in breakfast programs, community help programs, and the like. In more than 10 cities, the police wrecked their offices, stole thousands of dollars in funds, and arrested, beat, and shot occupants in planned, unprovoked attacks coordinated with the FBI, attacks in which more than 40 Panthers were murdered by police in that period, including Chicago leader, Panther leader Fred Hampton, who was shot dead while asleep in his bed. The suppression of community activists is a form of counterinsurgency, a way of keeping people victimized. A Chicago community worker observed as follows. I quote from a letter she wrote to me. I remember the police harassment assisted by the FBI. If it were not for their cruel and unjust campaign, there would probably be a top-notch Democratic community organization here, led by citizens groups and the Black Panthers. The leaders instead are all dead or in Marion Prison, Puerto Rican and black, and the Near West Side is still a disaster in spirit and physically. The despair that followed paved the way for drug traffickers to stake out the territory, and the feds helped them. To this day, kids are threatened from a very young age, and the family unit is fragmented by deplorable employment and housing policies. Unquote. So from a class control perspective, a demoralized, disorganized community is far more easily subjugated than a community operating with democratic unity and strength. You know, we're taught that in the United States there are no political prisoners. But in fact, we've endured a long history of politically motivated jailings. The great American labor leader Eugene Victor Debs and some 6,000 other socialists, pacifists, and radical labor organizers were imprisoned or deported during the First World War or immediately afterward in what was known as the Palmer Raids. That was the Attorney General Palmer just going around the country rounding up people whose opinions he didn't like. The anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti were arrested and eventually executed for a crime most investigators and historians say they never committed. These two immigrants were killed because they were anarchists. Numerous African-American leaders involved in progressive community causes and struggles against drug pushes were railroaded into prison on trumped-up charges. Martin Sostre, Frank Shufford, Eddie Carthen, Ben Chavis, In many of these cases, the police actually planted drugs on the community organizer who was fighting drugs to railroad them into jail, where they suffered astronomical prison sentences, solitary confinement and beatings and other mistreatment. But in contrast, the police seemed curiously protective of drug dealers. Leaders of black men's movement against crack in New York were spied on, harassed, arrested, and convicted of illegal possession of weapons, attempted escape, and assault, charges they repeatedly denied. Native American Indian activists Timothy Jacobs and Eddie Hatcher took over a Robeson County, North Carolina newspaper office one day to bring attention to rampant police corruption, drug dealing, racism, and murder by officials. Tried in federal court for kidnapping, they were acquitted. Tried again for the same action in state court, they were sentenced to prison for 25-year terms. There's the case of the Crips leader in Los Angeles, Dwayne Holmes, who brought peace between the gangs in L.A. and who was caught on trumped-up charges. Some provocateurs came to a community event that he was sponsoring and said that he stole $10. 20 witnesses said he did no such thing, and the police believed the provocateurs, arrested Dwayne Holmes. He had got a court-appointed lawyer who refused to call any of his defense witnesses. The lawyer was later made head of the Bar Association in that area, and Dwayne Holmes was sentenced to and is now serving 7 years in prison for this $10 theft, which he never committed. Prison inmates who propagate anti-capitalist or black nationalist views or Latino nationalist or Puerto Rican nationalist views who engage in prison protests have been singled out for mind control programs. Prisoners like the socialist Stephen Kessler, charged with disrupting a federal penitentiary by, quote, promoting racial unity, collectivizing the inmate population, attempting to secure legislative inquiries into prison conditions, and being involved with outside radical groups. Now, all those things I thought were part of his democratic rights and sounded like some pretty good things, too, promoting racial unity. But instead, Kessler, for his efforts, was placed in a behavior modification unit to be subjected to mind-altering drugs, beatings, forced rectal searches, prolonged shackling, isolation, and other tortures. In the words of one Oklahoma prisoner, quote, as long as prisoners confine themselves to gambling, shooting dope, running loan rackets, and killing each other, everything is fine. Let them pick up a book on Marxist theory, and they are immediately branded a communist agitator and locked in solitary confinement. In a class action suit, Warden Ralph Aaron testified that the special control unit in Marion Federal Penitentiary was used, quote, to control prisoners with revolutionary attitudes and tactics. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, over 300 members of the Black Panther Party were arrested, many held without bail or trial for long durations. By long durations, I mean 2 to 3 years without a trial. At least 15 former Panthers convicted on fabricated evidence and testimony that was subsequently recanted are still in prison, some for over 20 years, including Panther leader Geronimo Pratt, who has spent 8 of his 23 years of imprisonment in solitary confinement. Pratt was charged with murdering a woman when he was a 21-year-old UCLA student and a Panther leader in Los Angeles. He was convicted on the testimony of a witness who was identified years later as a paid FBI informant. The FBI conveniently lost their surveillance records showing that Pratt was in fact 400 miles away attending a Panther meeting in Oakland, California at the time of the LA murder. An ex-Panther facing the death penalty is Mumia Abu-Jamal, a radio journalist and former president of the Association of Black Journalists. He's still in prison after decades. After repeated harassment from law officers, he was shot when trying to stop police from beating his brother. An officer was killed by one of the bullets fired. Abu-Jamal was charged with the death, even though no weapon or ballistic evidence was ever produced linking him to the shooting. And he's still in prison today. In prison as of 1994, along with the Black Panthers, were former members of the American Indian Movement, including Leonard Peltier, who has been incarcerated for over 17 years, the Black Liberation Army members, members of the Republic of New Africa, a black separatist movement, Puerto Rican liberation activists, Irish nationalists, Chicano and North American anti-capitalist revolutionaries, community radical organizers, and peace activists. One Puerto Rican nationalist, Carmen Valentine, a housing activist, teacher, and organizer against police brutality, is serving a 98-year sentence for seditious conspiracy. Like his recent Republican predecessors, President Clinton has done nothing about any of these cases. Among U.S. political prisoners were the members of Plowshares, a peace group who jackhammered the concrete around a Minuteman missile silo in Kansas in 1984. For this protest action against nuclear weapons and demonstrating that, in fact, these weapons were first-use missiles because they weren't solidified against an attack, they were going to be used as a first-line attack. For this action, these protesters, 11 of them, were sentenced to 18 years in prison. Still in prison is Barbara Kurtzey Lahman, a white working-class woman once active in anti-racist organizing in what she called an underground anti-imperialist movement. She was given 15 years for, quote, seditious conspiracy, and has been threatened with additional sentences of 265 years. Another white woman, Linda Evans, organized so effectively against racism that the Louisiana Ku Klux Klan put her on their death list. To protect herself, she purchased guns using a false identification. For this and for harboring a fugitive, Evans was arrested and sentenced to and is serving 45 years. Susan Rosenberg, a revolutionary advocate and former acupuncturist, was arrested along with an anti-capitalist associate, Tim Blunk, for weapons possession and false identification. Both were convicted of just that, weapons possession and carrying a false identification, and each was given 58 years, and they're serving that time right now, consistently being denied parole. Silvia Baraldini, an Italian citizen, was an anti-war activist and sympathizer of Puerto Rican independence and black liberation. Refusing to testify before a grand jury in the USA, she was tried for conspiracy and criminal contempt and has sentenced and is serving 43 years in prison. Along with Susan Rosenberg and a Puerto Rican nationalist, Alejandrina Torres, Baraldini was held for 2 years in the high security unit at Lexington, Kentucky, enduring windowless, unadorned cells, deprived of fresh air and human contact, and subjected to constant surveillance by a battery of cameras and hostile male guards. In time, their eyesight and health deteriorated. None of these people that I've mentioned, none of these people were ever convicted of assaulting or injuring anyone. Mark Curtis, a packing house worker, a labor unionist, and a leader of the Socialist Worker Party, was arrested in Des Moines, Iowa, and charged with having sexually assaulted a 15-year-old. He was severely beaten and knocked unconscious by police. The alleged victim said her attacker was 5 feet 6 inches tall, had smoke on his breath, and broke into her house. Curtis is over 6 feet tall, does not smoke, and was in a restaurant with a dozen other people at the specified time of the rape. After Curtis was convicted on the testimony of one police officer, one of the jurors presented an affidavit indicating that she believed Mark Curtis was not guilty and that she was one of 4 who voted for conviction, even though they had grave doubts about the case. Curtis was sentenced to 25 years for sexual abuse and burglary, crimes he did not commit. During the Gulf War, some 2,000 military personnel were denied their requests for conscientious objector status and forced to go to war. At least 24 other service personnel refused on moral grounds to participate and were sentenced to military prison, some for as long as 6 years. A number of them were worked 12-hour days and fed starvation diets while incarcerated. In sum, political prisoners exist in the United States, and political prisoners receive grossly disproportionate sentences. They're routinely denied parole, even when qualifying for it, and are subjected to isolation, behavior modification, brutality, and other punitive treatments. Over the years, local and state police have worked closely with federal authorities to suppress anti-capitalist and other protest movements. The FBI devoted more effort to investigating the civil rights movement than to investigating the violence perpetrated against the civil rights movement. Those who engaged in the struggle against racial segregation in the South during the 1960s sometimes suffered physical assault and even death at the hands of white vigilantes, while police and FBI informants either looked the other way or actively assisted. Nowadays, police utilize billions of dollars worth of surveillance hardware provided by federal authorities against anti-capitalist groups and other dissident groups. In 1970, one police official declared that there were more law officers throughout the country, quote, on political intelligence assignments than are engaged in fighting organized crime. I don't doubt it. A RAND Corporation engineer has speculated that, quote, we could easily end up with the most effective, oppressive police state ever created, unquote. In various cities, secret police units, commonly known as Red Squads, spy on and harass lawful advocacy groups, sometimes poking into the private lives of public figures to embarrass or pressure them out of public life. Red Squads have monitored hundreds of thousands of individuals and organizations. Perhaps one reason authorities cannot win the war on crime and the war against drugs, quote, quote, is that they're too busy fighting the war against political dissent. As part of that war, the FBI launched a counterintelligence program called COINTELPRO, which in effect is still in operation. It's designed to expose, disrupt, and misdirect members of progressive groups of any stripe. Working closely with local police red squads and private right-wing organizations, the FBI used forged documents, illegal break-ins, intercepted mailings, telephone taps, undercover provocateurs, and false charges. The Bureau has infiltrated various labor unions in attempts to brand them communist-controlled and has cooperated with management in the surveillance of strikers. In contrast to the way they treat the left, federal agents have done little to discourage violent right-wing extremist groups and sometimes have supported their activities. In San Diego, the FBI financed a crypto-fascist outfit called the Secret Army Organization, whose operations range from burglary and arson to kidnapping and attempted murder. The FBI organized 41 Ku Klux Klan chapters in North Carolina alone. Who is the FBI working for? Paid FBI informants in the Klan did nothing to stop Klan members and Nazis who committed murder and other acts of violence. This was true in Greensboro, where four radicals were murdered by Klan members who were assisted and directed by FBI undercover agents in the Klan. In some instances, the FBI informants assist the murderers by procuring weapons for them and directing them to the correct location where the murder is going to take place. U.S. military intelligence and the Chicago Police Red Squad jointly operated an organization called the Legion of Justice. Its members clubbed and maced protesters and anti-war demonstrators, broke into their headquarters, stole files, vandalized a progressive bookstore, and committed other acts of disruption and violence. In Chicago, after repeated death threats, Rudy Lozano, a Chicano union organizer and anti-capitalist who worked remarkably effectively to unite Latinos, African Americans, and working class whites around working class causes and issues, Rudy Lozano, this wonderful, many people called him a saintly man, he was shot dead in his home by someone who came to his door on the pretense of asking for a drink of water and who stole nothing. According to family members, paramedics who arrived at the scene thought they could save Lozano's life, but police blocked them from getting near him because, quote, evidence might be destroyed. Of course, the police never had a clue and never apprehended the killer. In instances of right-wing violence against the left, police rarely manage to catch the perpetrators. Political violence, as such, seldom bothers the authorities. It depends on who is using it against whom. Thus, when asked what they intended to do about the 15 or so right-wing paramilitary terrorist camps within the United States, a Reagan-appointed Justice Department official said the camps did not appear to be in violation of any federal statute. When two Chicano socialists were killed by bombs planted in their cars, the FBI made no arrests. When a powerful bomb wrecked the offices of several progressive and civil liberties groups in New York, injuring three people, the police made only a perfunctory investigation. After a series of threats, an anti-nuclear organizer was shot dead in Houston, and an assistant was seriously wounded. Police came up with not a clue. If this is democracy, who needs dictatorship?
You heard Lazy Law and Social Control, Part 5 in a 12-part series of commentaries by Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is the author of many books, among them Democracy for the Few, Inventing Reality, Against Empire, and Dirty Truths.
Political movements today that challenge power and privilege fare no better than activists of the past at the hands of the police. The new anti-corporate globalization movement is being taken seriously and is subject to the sorts of repression that have historically been deployed. This includes preemptive raids and arrests and a rhetoric which criminalizes the very idea of protest. Continuing with a strategy begun in Washington, D.C., police at the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia admitted to engaging in surveillance on activists in order to locate and arrest those they termed as, quote, the ringleaders, unquote. Last week at the Republican National Convention in Philly, John Sellers, the executive director of the Ruckus Society, a nonprofit group which gives training classes in nonviolent civil disobedience, was arrested while walking on the street and held on $1 million bail. He was charged with conspiracy and possessing the instruments of a crime. The instrument of crime was his cell phone. Various reports indicate that officers were ordered to destroy activist cell phones and protest banners wherever possible. Possibly the most bizarre manifestation of police repression was the arrest of 78 puppet makers on conspiracy charges and the destruction of their large papier-mâché puppets. John Tarleton filed the following report with the Independent Media Center on August 3rd.
Police destroy puppets. Shock and dismay widespread. The grinding sound of a trash compactor could be heard from inside the former Ministry of Puppetganda for over 4 hours Wednesday as the police destroyed hundreds of papier-mâché puppets and sent them away in garbage trucks. It's obscene watching all these beautiful works of art being crushed in an illegal police activity, said Renard Thompson, a puppeteer from Colebrook, Connecticut. This is typical of the police. They do anything they can get away with, take it to court, and get a slap on the wrist. Approximately 75 puppeteers were arrested Tuesday evening after a dramatic televised standoff with police who claimed they possessed, quote, instruments of crime, unquote, inside their warehouse headquarters at 41st Street and Haverford Avenue. While police detectives began processing, quote, the crime scene on Wednesday morning, three more puppeteers were arrested for trying to obstruct a Department of License and Inspections garbage truck. Department of L&I Commissioner Ed McLaughlin said he didn't know what the building's specific fire and health code violations were. We're just taking the trash out, he said. We're responding to a police request. Police cordoned off Haverford from 41st to 42nd Street with yellow tape while neighborhood residents expressed shock at the crackdown. So they think this was a terrorist group and this was their clubhouse? Said Mike Davis, 28, a lifelong resident of West Philadelphia. That's crazy. Linda Harris, 53, lives one block from the warehouse. On Tuesday night, she gave three cases of water to dehydrated protesters who had been drumming and dancing in the street. She returned Wednesday to see what the police were doing. That's really sick. I can't believe it, she said. They're right up the street from a couple of crack houses, and they're worried about the puppets. We can't even begin to think how they think. Ronnie Kennedy, a worker for the Department of License and Inspection, was dismayed at having to destroy the puppets. I felt real bad, he said. I could see they must have taken a lot of time to make those puppets. They must have been fighting for a cause they believe in. Captain John Hargraves of the 39th Precinct helped oversee Wednesday's operations. He was more serene about his work. I don't have any feelings, he said. I am a professional. While the cleanup crew was hauling away the last of the debris, supporters of the 432 people arrested on Tuesday gathered in Franklin Park at 8th and Vine Street across from police headquarters. The Goats with a Vote puppet troupe put on a performance in the middle of the park. Their eight goat masks were the only survivors from the Great Puppet Massacre. One of the goats, Morgan Fitzpatrick, said the police had deliberately targeted the puppets, many of which had criminal justice themes. "That was our voice," he said. "Yesterday, when the media was saying that there was no clear message, that's because our clear messages were being destroyed." Jody Netzer of the Ministry of Puppetganda said she'd been in contact with 8 of the 30 women puppetistas who were in custody. She said the 8 women were dehydrated, had not been fed since morning, and were counseling about whether to give their fingerprints and move on to a regular jail cell that had water. Netzer also said that jail guards had confiscated signs and puppets that the prisoners had made out of ice cream wrappers and other trash they had found in the jail.
Scott Harris of the Independent Media Center recorded an interview with a dangerous puppet maker who had escaped the police dragnet as she participated in a solidarity demonstration outside Philadelphia's Roundhouse Jail, where the puppeteers were held with several hundred other arrested protesters.
We came over to this park across the street from the police station to put on our puppet show for the people who are gathering for a jail solidarity protest. We started our puppet show. The police came around on bicycles, encircled our puppet show, kind of crowded us in. Everyone started chanting, you know, "Free the puppets," and "The show must go on," and "The goat must vote," and the police left. It was very empowering, very exciting. Everyone held their ground. We continued with the show. Everyone continued to pour in, and it ended up with this large mass of people that's around us right now showing their support for the people who've been arrested, most of them without charges and often in very unhappy circumstances, no food, no water, etc.
So August 1st, 75 members, as I understand it, of the Puppetista Collective were arrested?
Yes, and none of them, as of last night, we saw them on the bus. They had said that they had been on the bus for 5 hours, still in restraints. Their hands were swollen. They had not had food or water, access to medical care, or access to any kind of phone for legal aid, any of that sort of thing. They were yelling to us to go call legal team. When we came back with advice from legal team, we were denied access to them to inform them of what we had found. Very sad.
What's your legal team saying now as to their situation, their status?
Well, as of last night, the legal team's advice was to demand their rights, demand food, demand water, stand together and make a lot of noise and not settle for less than, you know, what they really need, which is, I mean, very small things. Food and water is what they're asking for. So really solidarity among the jailed people.
A week before these actions started, the police targeted the puppet queue house. Why do you think puppets are so central to the police crackdown here in Philadelphia?
Well, I think the reason that most oppression works is because the people stand for it. And when they're empowered by music, by art, they're able to let out their spirit and they say, "Oh my God, I'm a live person, I love being alive, and I don't have to settle for crap. I don't need to be spat upon." And puppets really bring that out. It makes people really happy. It gives a great big voice. It presents to the media in a clear picture, we are here because we're unhappy with, you know, the jail system. We're unhappy with the two-party system. It really presents that well. And so it really is the most effective weapon. And the garbage about it maybe being bombs, it maybe being, you know, other explosives, it's just a load of, you know, hoo-ha. Because really, they're afraid of the message. They know that if people get excited, they will demand what they want. And what they want is not to be oppressed anymore.
Do you think the message that thousands of people brought here to Philadelphia, dissatisfaction with the status quo, the two-party system, as you said, the criminal injustice system, as the organizers have stated, do you think that message got across this week in Philadelphia?
I'm not sure whether it got into the delegates. I'm sure that it got across to the people who are here, because we have different messages. We're sharing them with each other. And through the thousands of people who are here, each person knows a couple hundred people. When they see what's happening in the major media, the misrepresentation, they say, "Hey, we were there. We know that didn't happen like that." They get disgruntled, and the word spreads. And for that, it certainly, I think, is spreading across. The rapid acceleration of these type of protests are really empowering people to really speak up. People get more and more bold. They realize more and more that they can demand what's rightfully theirs, and they should.
Where do you think the movement's headed next?
I think, well, it's directly next. It's headed to the Democratic Convention for the same exact thing. It's headed, of course, again over to the World Bank IMF in Prague. I think more and more people are going to be in their local areas upset with banks that are merging and merging and merging with less and less service. In other areas, healthcare, I think, is going to be a major area because the HMOs are cracking down and being very tight with money and not putting human interest first. All these areas that are corporations with profits, you know, first in their mind, I think that's where people are going to go first and next. And they're going to go with a vengeance because they're going to realize they're not getting their fair share.
That was Elizabeth Tubbs from Worcester, Massachusetts, interviewed by Scott Harris of the Independent Media Center in Philadelphia. If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. Travelers.